This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, thank you for staying with us. It is 7:36 in the morning, 29th of April, 2022. Now, let's turn our attention to refugees. And according to the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, the global refugee population has been on the rise. A record number of over 26 million refugees have been forced to leave their homes, and 68% of the world's refugees come from just five countries.
And refugees are defined and protected under the 1951 Refugee Convention relating to the status of refugees, and the convention serves as the foundation of international refugee law. Both the convention and the subsequent 1967 protocol covers the definition, the legal status, and the rights and obligations of refugees in their country of asylum. It is importantly also, it covers the state's obligations, including cooperating with UNHCR in the application of the convention.
Now, as of 20th January 2020, there are 146 countries that are party to this convention and 147 countries that are party to the protocol. Malaysia, however, is not a party to the convention or the protocol. Despite having these policies and measures that were put in place to protect refugees, many, however, are still living in vulnerable states with poor living conditions, employment bans and limitations, in also inaccessibility to education and healthcare.
So for more understanding of this, we now turn to Phil Robertson, the Deputy Director of the Asia Division at the Human Rights Watch, to break down the issue and the policy for us. Now, Phil, good morning. Now, according to the UNHCR, the global refugee population has more than doubled in the past decade, with 27 million on record. Is war the main factor that's driving this increase in refugee populations, or are there other factors as well?
Well, war is certainly a major factor in many protracted refugee situations, and I'm thinking about countries like Syria or Ethiopia or Afghanistan and obviously Ukraine now. But I would think that one of the major underlying factors is really political persecution. And sometimes that persecution results in war, but sometimes it just leads to a massive violence against a certain people, as we saw in the crimes against humanity and acts of genocide that were committed by the Myanmar military against the Rohingya, ethnic Rohingya from Rakhine State in Burma. And, you know, that happened in 2017. But in other cases, it's also just about dictatorial rule and rights abuses that prompt people to flee their country and become refugees. So if you look at Vietnam, you look at Cambodia, you look at North Korea, people are continuing to flee those countries because they just cannot stay there. Sometimes it's cases of discrimination. We could look at the case of the LGBT rights activist Noor Sajat, who fled Malaysia last year and became a refugee in Australia because she was discriminated on who she was.
I'm just curious, though, is there a difference? And, you know, because we hear this term, economic refugee versus political refugee. What's the difference? And should there be a difference?
There is no such thing as an economic refugee. What that is an effort by governments to try to claim that people who are refugees are really economic migrants. It's an effort to try to strip people of the protections that they would get as a refugee. You know, they're trying to lump refugees into groups of people who are coming to different countries just to try to get jobs or other sort of economic benefits.
Yeah, Phil, if we can turn to, well, you know, one of the countries, refugees you mentioned earlier, Syria, and I think anecdotally and in certain news reports as well, there are reports of, you know, quite considerable civil strife in countries like Belgium, Luxembourg, and even France with war refugees and Syrian refugees clashing with local populations there, possibly due to disenfranchisement of civil liberties as well. How are governments dealing with this, and are they effective in doing so?
Well, I think that a lot of governments are not dealing with it terribly well. I mean, if you're going to accept refugees, you have to provide certain protections for them. You need to make sure that they have some ability to adjust to their situation, particularly if they've gone to a third country for a resettlement. You want to provide them with opportunities to get meaningful livelihoods, to be able to really adjust their lives. And in many of these places, that simply is not happening. The refugees are just sort of left out on the street. I mean, if you look at some of the countries where the refugee resettlement is most effective, and I'm thinking of countries like Canada or the United States, you know, there's a whole sort of system to receive refugees and to provide them with basic assistance, to have voluntary agencies that are helping them out, you know, as in their adjustment, helping them try to get their kids to school and get people into jobs. You know, it takes a lot of work. I mean, any sort of situation like this, you would expect that if if you don't tend to it well, there's going to be a problem. And I think what we've seen in places like Europe is a lot of discrimination against refugees from places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, while on the other hand, they are welcoming with open hands the refugees from Ukraine. So, you know, there's a bit of a double standard here, and depending on who the refugees are.
Yeah. So how are these, you know, these iniquities being monitored and policed, and who should do it, Phil?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of civil society groups, people like Human Rights Watch and others, are paying close attention. And when we see a government do the wrong thing, we're going to call them out. But I think that, you know, people in that country themselves should be able to do that as well. I mean, it's not just one group of people who are anti-foreigner, although, you know, we have seen the rise of, for instance, right-wing populists, so-called populists in various places in Europe and the United States who, you know, treat anybody from another part of the world as somehow their enemy. And I think we need to get past that. I mean, this is the era of globalization, and it's time to recognize that people need protection regardless of where they're from.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into this, because the UNHCR has supervisory responsibilities in terms of the Refugee Convention. But what happens when a country that has a signatory to the convention is not in compliance with it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, UNHCR, like any UN agency, has a difficulty in compelling governments to do anything. You know, the UN has the Refugee Convention and the UNHCR have the ability to issue refugee status on their own. And in some cases, like, for instance, in Malaysia, that is what has happened. There has been the exercise of the mandate authority of UNHCR to extend refugee protection to people. But, you know, the problem is that a lot of times these governments, you know, say, oh, well, the Refugee Convention doesn't really apply here, when it really does, because it is customary international law, or they try to take shortcuts. And many of them don't cooperate with UNHCR in any significant way. So if we look at what happened just recently in Malaysia with the escape of the Rohingya from that camp last week, you know, the Malaysian government has shut the UNHCR out of immigration detention centers since August 2019. That's outrageous and unacceptable. Previously, UNHCR was allowed to go into those camps. They would check and screen people. If someone was a refugee and had been arrested and ended up in the camp, they could be let out. And they could also accept applications for people who claimed that, you know, they were fleeing political persecution and were refugees, and that they should be considered as a refugee. And UNHCR was able to conduct refugee status determination interviews under their mandate. And that's the sort of cooperation we should see. And that was happening until August 2019. And then inexplicably, Immigration and the Ministry of Home Affairs decided to no longer allow that to happen.
And is this in part because Malaysia is not party to the 1951 Refugee Convention or has signed up to the 1967 Protocol?
Well, I think Malaysia is an outlier. Frankly, you know, they have failed to protect refugees the way they should, and they should ratify that convention and the protocol. But it's more than just that. I think that there was a degree of cooperation pre-August 2019 that was working fairly well. And for some reason, it has stopped. And UNHCR has sought through every channel to try to figure out what is going on and what changed and why they can't have access to these immigration detention centers. You know, and if you know, UNHCR had access to those immigration detention centers, it gives people in those centers a bit of hope, you know, that they're not so desperate that they decide to finally break down the fences and make a run for it.
That was Phil Robertson, Deputy Director of the Asia Division of the Human Rights Watch. And just in terms of the humanitarian crisis and the refugee migration patterns, you just get the feeling that we are on the cusp of something maybe more significant, with more military conflicts around the world, more climate change that is threatening sea levels, and more inward-bound migration. Food security is an issue. People are migrating towards more fertile lands. These things, I think, will amplify in time to come.
Yeah, so let's bring the conversation back home to Malaysia. And I'm referring to the Frankly Speaking column, actually, in The Edge, who highlighted some interesting facts. As of December last year, Malaysia, we have 180,000 refugees and asylum seekers, which are registered with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. The vast majority of them, comprising 86% of them, are actually Myanmar from Myanmar, and of course, many Rohingyas. Now, Malaysia, like what we highlighted, is not a party to the 1951 Refugee Convention, and neither did we sign up to the 1967 Protocol. So the point is, the government is then forced to treat them as illegal immigrants and must therefore detain them at public cost. Now, the other issue is why haven't we signed up? That's one thing. The second thing is actually the Frankly Speaking column does bring up the issue about why don't we allow them to actually work legally? We are having a labour shortage in this country. Why don't we allow them to work, let them earn some money and maybe earn some, in their own way, a livelihood?
Absolutely. Those are good questions that I think the government must answer.
Well, we are apparently looking at it. The Ministry of Human Resource is looking into the matter, but let's hope we get an answer soon.
Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.